Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome back to Overnight America. Now past 11 o'clock. We're here with you live until 2 o'clock. And our friend Rich Rubino is going to join us in the next segment. Here's the phone number if you want to call or text. It's 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. What was I listening to? I was listening to a podcast and they were making fun of radio shows that give the phone number out too often. He said, that's how you can tell they're desperate for people to call in if they give the phone number out five times in a row. I get that. Well, thank you for the last week and everyone that filled in, Brad Young and Clint Hosse. And I hope you enjoyed the Thanksgiving special that was Thursday night. I really enjoyed putting it together. If you heard it and you have any feedback, you can always text in and let me know what you think of it. I'm going to get to our friend Rich Rubino coming up in a few minutes. Michael Jackson look-alike prompts fans to believe he's still alive. Is this going to be the big hoax, the big next hoax, which is he's really alive, he never died? Wouldn't that be something? But I wanted to start the hour in a special way. I missed a whole other story. Kevin Kling did a great one on Thanksgiving.
At every Thanksgiving dinner table, there's that one person who stands out. Molly Brown says when she thinks back on it,
usually it was my dad. Typically, he would throw rolls across the table to my mom.
What provoked that?
One year, he did it kind of as a joke, and my mom said, toss me a roll. And so then he tossed her a roll, and then it would happen every year after that.
Grandparents sometimes stand out the most. Melanie Hager remembers her grandpa could take over the table.
He always had a story, and he always used all of the stuff on the dinner table as props for the story.
At Thanksgiving?
Oh, yeah. So
What kind of story would he tell?
Just stories of his childhood and just different things. He was super into sports. He played basketball, so he was always talking about all these different stories and these things that happened when he was playing basketball, and he'd grab the salt and pepper shakers and stuff like that to set up props to show you what was happening in the story, and you knew the second he grabbed those props that the story was going to last an hour. You were stuck there. You weren't going anywhere
for a
while.
What if you needed the salt?
Well, then you were SOL until he was done with his story.
When he thinks back on Thanksgiving, Darren Smith says the biggest personality of his boyhood...
Well, it was always my father. He was a military guy, and he was big on family, and he was very big on holidays. You know, he led the conversation. You pretty much went along to what he said.
What sort of questions or statements would he make at Thanksgiving?
He always wanted to ask him, what were you thinking? Like, you know, this is Thanksgiving. What are you thankful for?
And they go around the table?
And just go around the table. That was always a big thing.
Now, when it was coming around to you, would you think, oh my gosh, what am I going to say?
What I would do is I would listen to what everybody else said and kind of ride on their coattail, which he would catch on to, like, no, that's not good enough. Tell me something about you.
Many of the Thanksgiving characters of our youth are gone. But Smith says, in a way, they set the table for how we act ourselves now at Thanksgiving.
My sister always makes a little joke to me. She's like, you know, Dad is not really gone. I'm like, she goes, no, you act just like him. He's still here.
All right, well, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
With a whole other story, I'm Kevin Killeen.
Oh, so good. So many great Thanksgiving memories. We shared a bunch of those on Thursday night of last week. And I don't know if I made any new Thanksgiving memories this time around. There's those memories when you are a kid and you look back and you think about what the grown-ups did, or all that time so-and-so did that. I feel like those memories didn't happen to me this year, which is fine. It's not like every year something crazy or memorable needs to happen, as if I need to go out there and it's my turn to do something crazy. But I like the idea, the very first memory that came up in that whole nother story, about throwing a roll at someone. Maybe next Thanksgiving I'll pick up a roll and I'll throw it at my wife, unprovoked. Honey, this will be our new tradition. When you're not paying attention, I'll throw a dinner roll at you. And then you feed it to the dog after it hits the floor. Is it worth having your wife mad at you for the rest of the day? Maybe. Because the first time she would be, the second time she would probably be half as angry. There's like a half life. There's every year it's a half as angry as the last. Third year, you know, it's about 25% as angry. Fourth year, you know, it's half, half, half. And then before you know it, she'll just expect it and accept it. And then you have to find something different, like maybe dunk the roll into gravy first. Now, that would change some things, wouldn't it? I was going around and looking at some commentaries that were posted online. Andy Rooney did some really great commentaries for 60 Minutes back in the day. Way back in the day. He had his desk and he had his books and there was the clutter. And Andy, don't you know, type of mindset. And I thought, you know, if at all we're going to be playing some Andy Rooney, tonight would be the night. Considering I was off last week, considering I missed Thanksgiving on the airwaves here at KMOX, even though I put that special together, still, I was off. I feel like this is the appropriate time because it is Cyber Monday. People are spending a ton of money online. CBS even led with that in their news, the top of the hour news. It's still Cyber Monday and people are clicking away and people will be spending so much money towards Christmas. I love what Andy Rooney had to say about it back in 2002 before all of this Cyber Monday stuff started taking over.
One of the ways we divide our year is with holidays. The 4th of July is the beginning of summer. Labor Day is the beginning of the new year. New Year's Day isn't really the beginning of anything except a new calendar. Thanksgiving is our most American holiday, and it's good because we don't have to do anything on Thanksgiving except maybe eat turkey and watch football. That's why I object to the way it's being squeezed out by Christmas. The trouble is, there's no money in Thanksgiving for businesses. People trying to sell things want to skip right over it and get to Christmas. Christmas is far and away the most commercial holiday we have. Some stores do 30% of their whole year's business in the period before Christmas. That's why they try to make it last a long time by starting it earlier every year. Here it is 4 days before Thanksgiving, and the stores are already all about Christmas. The big department stores have their Christmas windows fixed up. They're good to look at, but they're too soon, that's all. It ought to be against the law to start Christmas before December. In the malls, some stores have had their Christmas decorations up since October. Kids are sitting on Santa Claus's lap telling him what they want before their parents know where they're going to get the money to pay for it. In New York City, they put up the tree in Rockefeller Center 10 days ago, 41 days before Christmas. The Salvation Army already has its bell ringers on the streets looking for Christmas donations. Everyone is trying to make whatever it has to sell at this time of year seem like a Christmas present. Shoes are not a Christmas present at any time of year. On television, they're unlikely Christmas gifts. How'd you like a bottle of Pepto-Bismol for Christmas? For the past 6 weeks, we've been getting magazines with special Christmas or holiday subscription offers. When you open a magazine, these holiday flyers fall out like confetti. In advertising, holiday is the new religiously correct name for Christmas. I like Christmas presents, Christmas music, Christmas trees, Christmas cards. I like the Christmas spirit. What I don't like is the way people whose only interest in Christmas is money have moved in on a nice non-commercial holiday like Thanksgiving.
Good old Andy Rooney from 2002 talking about Christmas and Thanksgiving. How about this? I was taken away. One of our TVs is on CBS right now, and there's a Michael Bloomberg 2020 ad. This has got to be like a 2-minute ad because it's still going on. I didn't know he's buying TV ads so quickly. You know, the funny thing is we're going to be talking about Michael Bloomberg and his run for presidency, the strategy of what it may force the Democrats to do with our guest host, Rich Rubino, coming up next. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
Joining us now is the author of American Politics on the Rocks. We check in with him on Mondays on Overnight America. Rich Rubino, thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me again.
It's good to have you back. The last week was a little bit weird, so I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I enjoyed mine. So I wanted to talk about what's going on with the races. Thanksgiving week's kind of a lull. I don't know if a lot of people pay attention to politics Thanksgiving week. I think most are concerned about their families or purposely not paying attention to politics. And I'm wondering, in your household, are there any political debates that come onto the table Thanksgiving Day?
No, not really. Not really.
That's probably for the best.
It's actually, it's interesting. I hear so many people say, you know, how do we get through these Thanksgiving with the relatives and how do we get through? I always say, well, it's pretty simple. Just don't talk about politics.
Yeah.
Talk about anything else. It's not that complicated. There are so many other subjects. Talk about aluminum siding.
Aluminum siding. Do you know a lot about aluminum siding?
Well, I guess you could go to Wikipedia beforehand, and then as soon as someone talks about politics, bring up aluminum siding and try to change the subject. Just try to divert it to something else, unless you want to have an educated political discussion. But I know a lot of people don't want to go through kind of a divisive Thanksgiving, particularly if you're having it with somebody you're only going to see once or twice a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's fascinating, though. You just go on the Internet and go on so many Facebook posts. It's fascinating how many people seem to enjoy debating politics with strangers.
Yep. Well, over the past week, has there been much that's changed in the political race for the 2020 presidency?
A little bit. What seems to be going on right now is, so Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, who's worth about $52 billion, he's declared that he's going to run, and he has an interesting strategy in that he's going to essentially skip the first four states.
Ooh.
So conventional thinking is that the way you win, you go to Iowa, then New Hampshire, then you go to Nevada, then you go to South Carolina. In terms of contemporaneously, what happened, the reason that strategy, kind of the small state strategy, people will look at Jimmy Carter, for example, in 1976, former one-term governor of Georgia, had a lot of formidable opponents, Frank Harris from Oklahoma, Senator, Scoop Jackson from Washington, Jerry Brown, the current governor at the time of California. So Jimmy Carter spends an enormous amount of time in Iowa, and he really does it, you know, with himself just out there with handing out brochures, and he had his peanut brigade, Polk from Georgia, going off campaigning, and he wins Iowa, then he goes on to win New Hampshire, and eventually he becomes immutable. There's a movement to try to stop him with Jerry Brown and then Frank Church of Idaho, but he goes on to win the nomination. Mm-hmm. So the conventional thinking is that that's how you win. You do all this retail politicking. That's not really Mike Bloomberg's style. The only office he's ever won is mayor of New York City, which is obviously the largest city in the country. So he's not necessarily going to do the strategy of going to Iowa and going to town halls. Like, you know, for example, Amy Klobuchar is going to go to all 99 counties in Iowa. Mm. He's going to skip all those, wait till March 3rd, when you have a lot of super delegate states like California, Massachusetts, Vermont, and he's going to try to win there. And it's not necessarily going to be these, you know, going to a coffee shops, having town halls. A lot of it's just going to be he's going to blanket the airwaves in a lot of these states. And it's an interesting strategy. It's more wholesale than retail. Which is what happens essentially in a general election. You know, you don't have the candidates spending a lot of time, for example, in Iowa and New Hampshire, meeting with individual voters. They spend a lot of their time going from tarmac to tarmac to tarmac. And that's what I think a lot of what Bloomberg's going to try to do. So it's an interesting strategy.
Yeah, it is. Considering when we look back at 2016, one of the criticisms they had of Hillary Clinton was that she kind of skipped a lot of these different areas, right? She kind of went around during her presidency, and that ended up hurting her. You know, she wasn't really as present as a normal candidate would. So what's the advantages of that? Why would Michael Bloomberg look at what happened in 2016 and think that perhaps this would be a strategy to repeat and he would be more successful doing it?
Well, with Hillary, it was more in the general election. She competed in the primaries against Bernie Sanders, and the general election is where she essentially ignored the state of Wisconsin, never even made a visit there, and ended up losing by 23,000 votes. She was spending time in places like Arizona, where she thought she could siphon off from Donald Trump, from the Republicans, but because of the influx of Latino voters, but she wasn't able to do that. There have been some precedent for this strategy in the past. The one that comes to mind is Al Gore, 1988, not 2000, but 1988. He was 40 years old, and essentially he said at the time that he didn't like the arcane rules of Iowa, so he skipped Iowa, spent very little time in New Hampshire, waited to go to Super Tuesday, and then on Super Tuesday he actually won about seven states. He was the last really Southern Democrat that ran as a Southern Democrat, very popular with white Southerners. He won Tennessee, Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, a lot of those states. But he wasn't really necessarily able to translate it to the next elections. Eventually, he went to New York, and he was endorsed by the mayor of New York City, Ed Koch, but he lost it. And the other issue that Al Gore had was some of the southern states actually split with Jesse Jackson, because Jesse Jackson was able to siphon off a lot of the states that had particularly African-American supporters. So it didn't work for Al Gore. 2000, he runs again for president. He campaigns vociferously in Iowa, New Hampshire, wins both, goes on to beat Bill Bradley in just about every contest. 2004, Wesley Clark skipped Iowa. Joe Lieberman originally started campaigning in Iowa, then decided his strategy was going to change. He was going to spend most of his time in New Hampshire instead. So as a result, he didn't participate in the caucuses, went on to campaign in New Hampshire, never really did very well in any of the primaries, ended up dropping out. So there really isn't much precedent for somebody just dropping, just not really support campaigning in those few states and then hoping that they could win in a more wholesale type of a campaign. But I think what Michael Bloomberg is doing, though, is he's figuring, you know, I have a lot of money, and he's figuring I can do something that's kind of unprecedented, if you will. And part of that is going to be a lot of these states have open primaries. So meaning that they can have independents can vote in Democratic presidential elections. So he could potentially say that he thinks that he's going to win some centrists, some independents, maybe even some Republicans who become independents to vote for him in some of those primaries. But it's a really risky strategy. But when you have, you know, $50 billion, I guess you might as well try it.
That's all, only $50 billion only.
Well, I guess if you're Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, it's only $50 billion. It's all relative.
Yeah.
For the average person, $50 billion is probably a lot of money. And, you know, it's going to be a big question is going to be, you know, how much support does that translate? I mean, Tom Steyer is also a billionaire. It's only about a 2 or 3% in the polls, and he's, you know, spending an inordinate amount of money, but it hasn't necessarily translated to votes for him yet. And there have been examples, by the way, of billionaires who have run races. Michael Huntington in California, for example, who ran for Senate race and don't necessarily do very well, despite the fact that they're spending that much money. So you do it does have to translate into, you know, likability. It has to translate into actually having a message that strikes a resonant chord with the electorate. Just the fact that you have a lot of money is certainly not tantamount to a victory.
Yeah, he's no Ross Perot or, in this case, Donald Trump, even, if you want to talk about someone that comes in.
Yeah,
and
that's somebody
about the money.
who was able to use his fortune and was able to win a race that only Michael Moore and Ann Coulter thought he could win.
Rich Rubino, the book American Politics on the Rocks, which you can find on Amazon. Again, what's the website if they wanted to check out your blog?
Just go to www.polita-geek.com.
I want to talk to you about the No Malarkey bus tour in general.
Oh, yes.
I like it when politicians go out on the road and they got the big branded bus. And I want to talk to you about what could potentially happen convention time if there's not enough delegates that could agree who should be their nominee, because it's an interesting brokered convention. We'll talk to our friend Rich Rubino coming up next on Overnight America KMOX. Joining us again, our friend Rich Rubino. Every Monday, you can check him out on Overnight America here in his book, American Politics on the Rocks. You can get on Amazon. You can also look him up online. Rich Rubino, thank you again for sticking around. I keep seeing the Joe Bidens of the world out on tour, and I see him doing speeches. You know, they set up the temporary podiums in the stages, and he goes up and he says a few words, and he's got the big branded bus in the background. It's the branded No Malarkey bus tour.
Yeah.
So politicians hitting the road via bus. Do you think that is one of those just obligatory things that'll happen to pretty much every campaign at some point?
Oh, absolutely. One thing it does is I think it humanizes the candidate. One issue that Joe Biden, he's been in public life since 1972. He's been vice president for 8 years, and, you know, where he had Secret Service around him. It's actually an opportunity for him to do, we're talking about what Michael Bloomberg won't be able to do in terms of retail politics. It's able for him to go to Iowa, go into small crowds, meet people, and people actually see him as somebody other than somebody that's kind of, you know, somebody that you kind of look to, almost genuflect to, because it's the office that he holds. In many respects, it does humanize him, but it also is also the risk that he has. You know, every time, everybody that you meet, someone's going to ask some off-the-wall question or something to that effect, and he's going to go off on some sort of a tangent, and then all of a sudden it's going to be the next day that's all people are going to talk about. So that's one of the fears that you have when you do that, but it definitely is something that he needs to do. It's his way of showing that he's not going to take Iowa and retail politicking for granted, that he's going to go to these places. Amy Klobuchar, by the way, is going to go to all 99 counties, believe it or not. And that's why I think that she's somebody who potentially could be a wild card here in terms of finishing very well in Iowa, because she's going to all the places that the other candidates aren't going to. She's going to extremely rural parts of the state. Now, the problem with that is there aren't that many people there, but if you can win enough caucus goers to actually come out and support you, like John Edwards did in 2004, for example, she could be a surprise there.
You know, it's funny. I've seen a couple of the things pop up on Twitter. One, Joe Biden nibbling on a woman's finger.
Yes.
Do they actually ride the bus? Because we had this controversy here in Missouri back when there was the Senate race between Josh Hawley and Claire McCaskill, who was the incumbent. And she had the bus and she was going to go all across Missouri. But, you know, she wanted to sound more rural. So she started calling it Missouri just for the election campaign. But, you know, there's all the videos of her hopping on her private jet while the bus was driving around. So she wasn't on this thing. Is Joe Biden actually, do politicians actually ride on these buses?
Yes, they do, actually. They do, actually. And some of them, I mean, John McCain, part of the reason in 2000 he really came out from the political abyss to actually beat George W. Bush in New Hampshire is he did what was called the Straight Talk Express. So what he would do is while they were going from municipality to municipality, he would sit there and essentially reporters would be able to ask him any question they wanted. So you're actually doing stuff while you're on the bus. It's not you're not just sitting there in a dark bus waiting to get from point A to point B. You're actually lots of times you're talking to reporters, you're doing interviews, you're calling up benefactors saying, you know, can I have a little bit more money, that type of thing. So it's almost like a working office.
Yeah, in a bathroom.
There was an acting governor from Massachusetts named Jane Swift who lived on the opposite side of the state. And she would literally travel 2.5 hours from one side to the other every day with a trooper essentially driving a Jeep going back one way and the other, one way from the other. And later I said, why do you do this? And she said, well, she gets a lot of work done while sitting in the back of the SUV.
Wow, that is not efficient.
The commute from hell, I would say.
Yeah, no kidding. Rich Rubino joins us here on Overnight America. And outside of some of the different things you're seeing right now, tactics that some of the politicians are using, I don't think anyone's dropped out in the past 2 weeks.
They have actually today. Actually, yesterday. You had, first of all, Joe Sestak, and I know you're going to say who. he was a former, actually an admiral, one of the most decorated people ever to serve in the House of Representatives. He was elected in 2006, served two terms. Made the not sagacious decision in 2010. He decides he's going to run for a Senate seat, beats Arlen Specter in the primary, then loses to Pat Toomey in the general election, then runs again and loses. So he's a two-time loser in Pennsylvania. He decides he's going to run for president. No one in the media takes him seriously. He never registers 1% in the polls. He dropped out. But the more formidable candidate was actually Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who was somebody who actually was reelected as governor of Montana in 2016 by 4 points, the same day where Donald Trump was elected, won the state with 20 points, and Steve Bullock won about 25% of Trump supporters. So that was his argument. That was his argument was that you elect me, I can win Republican voters. He got into one debate. He did relatively well in another debate. In that debate, and people were talking about him potentially as a moderate alternative should Joe Biden falter. But after that, he was never able to garner enough support to get into any future debates. So he dropped out, and now Montana Democrats are absolutely beseeching him to run against Steve Daines, who's the incumbent senator. He keeps saying that he's not going to do it. There's going to be a lot of pressure put upon him because he has probably 99% name recognition in the state. He's got job approval ratings about 60%. So he may be the only one who could actually defeat him. The question is, could Chuck Schumer, the House, the Senate minority leader, if they get the majority, could he potentially award him some sort of a chairmanship or give him some sort of a prize to get him in? He seems very reluctant to want to be one of 100 senators, but he could be the only person who could potentially win that seat and maybe potentially give the Senate to the Democrats.
Oh, interesting. So let's say we continue to see the very busy and the very crowded field of Democrats that want their party's nomination. And let's say the Bloombergs of the world, they start to succeed, and perhaps he may be getting to the point where there's a brokered convention. Can you explain that process of what happens if there's not one person that has enough delegates to vote for them to become their nominee?
So at least in the Democratic Party, you need almost 2,000 delegates to be declared the winner. So you can do this in terms of it actually – the delegates are actually counted at the convention. You win them in the primaries, and they're also superdelegates. There's a bunch of pledge electors. It's a whole mathematical formula. But basically, at the convention, there's going to be a roll call, and most of the states will say, we award, you know, it's going to be, say, Vermont, you know, then they say the great state, the Green Mountain State, and they say, we award our votes to the next president of the United States, and everyone cheers, and it's usually universal. There may be a few recalcitrant folks who vote for the person they voted support in the primary. But basically it's a preordained who's going to get the nomination. I mean, last time in 2016, for example, Hillary Clinton had won in the primaries. She had enough delegates. Everyone knew she was going to get the nomination. Superdelegates, essentially all, a lot of them who supported Bernie Sanders, ended up supporting her as well. Some actually didn't. There were some recalcitrant folks. But basically there's a certain number that you have. And if you don't reach that number, what happens is they do another vote. And if you go back to 1924, in 1924, there was actually, in the Democratic side, there was 103 separate ballots before John W. Davis, who no one had ever heard of, mm-hmm. landed up winning the nomination. The front runner that year was William McAdoo, the former Treasury Secretary in the Wilson administration. He didn't get enough delegates, just kept going on and on and on for about a week, and finally it came down to the point where the convention chose the person that they had never heard of, who ends up losing in a landslide to Calvin Coolidge. The last time there were brokered conventions, by the way, was 1952. In the Republican side, it was Eisenhower against Robert Taft, the son of William Howard Taft, who was a senator from Ohio, nicknamed Mr. Republican. Eisenhower ended up garnering the nomination at the convention and ended up going on to winning the presidency. Also that year, the Democratic side, interestingly, because this was Harry Truman did not seek re-election, and you had Adlai Stevenson, the governor of Illinois, who was not running for president. He was running for re-election as governor of Illinois. And the convention that year was in Chicago, so he gave an address welcoming the delegates. Harry Truman wanted him to be the nominee. There was pressure on him to put his tool after the first ballot, and they did not get a nominee. Mm-hmm. One of those, Alvin Barkley, was the vice president, but there were a lot of union leaders that said they weren't going to support him. So eventually, Stevenson says, "Okay, you can let me be the run for president." And they can let me put my name into nomination. He does, and he ends up getting the nomination. The only thing, similarly, 1880, James Garfield was there as a member of the Ohio delegation nominating James Sherman for president, and people liked what he said. They started yelling, "We want Garfield, we want Garfield." After a few more disputed ballots, they just put despite the fact he never wanted the nomination, wasn't there, Garfield ends up getting the nomination. Now, this has come close a couple times, but it hasn't happened since then. 68, Humphrey landed up winning at the convention. 1976, Gerald Ford ended up beating Ronald Reagan by the hair of his chinny chin chin by winning Mississippi, winning just a few more delegates to be able to win the nomination. And then in 1980, you had Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy, and Jimmy Carter was able to win the nomination before it went to the ballot. But it was an extremely close election. So that's essentially what happens. It really needed a perfect storm against the process for this to happen. In the Democratic side, you know, there are 3,976 pledged delegates. You need about 1,990 in order to win the nomination. So the possibility is, let's say in Iowa, let's say Pete Buttigieg wins. Uh-huh. Then you go to New Hampshire, let's say Elizabeth Warren wins. Then you go to Nevada, let's say in Nevada Bernie Sanders wins. Then you go to South Carolina, and then Joe Biden wins. So essentially, there's very little traction from those first few states. Then you go to Super Tuesday on March 3rd, and let's say Bloomberg cleans up with a bunch of states. And you keep going on, all five candidates keep going on and on and on. They don't reach that threshold. Then you go to the convention, and then you have a brokered convention.
Mm-hmm. That's complicated, but it makes good, I guess, news networks are salivating at the idea of something like this happening right now.
By the way, sometimes it'll happen at the state level. There might be a state convention, and then some states might have, for example, in some states you need 15% of the delegates in order to get your name on the ballot. So sometimes there'll be brokered conventions, and maybe one candidate will say, "I'll give you some of my delegates in order to get on there if you do something." So it happens more at the state level, but it doesn't happen since 1952 at the presidential level.
Yeah. Rich Rubino joining us here on Overnight America. One last question for you.
Yes.
With all the candidates they're going around, why do they all like to go to diners and ice cream shops? That's the only two places they stop at when they go into these small areas, and they love it when the cameras are there.
Yeah, that's Joe Biden. Joe Biden's forte, in many respects, is doing that. I think lots of times they set it up beforehand. So they walk in there, and it's usually they get people that are kind of off guard. They're saying, you know, what's going on here? And it actually can be awkward for candidates that aren't very good at small talk. because, you know, you go up there and it seems very awkward. Someone's got you know, a Baltimore Orioles hat. You go, oh, how are the Orioles doing, or something to that effect.
Uh-huh.
And when you're watching some of this stuff on TV, you watch C-SPAN for an hour or so, you can see that the candidates are very uncomfortable. The line that usually they like to say is they'll say something like, oh, hi, how are you? Nice to see you. Thank you for being here. The problem is sometimes people want to talk to him longer and longer.
Yeah, of course.
John Kerry, rather, in 2003, was in New Hampshire, and he was in a diner. And he stopped by, and a guy came, and so we actually sat down with the guy. The guy said, I have a question for you. And John, I remember watching this on C-SPAN, and John Kerry said, oh, yes. And then he's hoping it's going to be a policy question. The guy says, how do you get your hair like that? And then John Kerry says, oh, you know, I have a good barber, ha ha, kept laughing. The guy just keeps going on and on and on about John Kerry's hair, and all the media is filming him doing that. Another instance that I thought was fascinating was Mitt Romney was going into a diner, and so there was a World War II veteran, and he had a hat on, and he walked over to him, and the guy said he had a question, and he thinks it's going to be something about veterans issues, something like that. So Romney looks at him, and then the guy says, I got a question for you. He says, what's your position on gay marriage? And then John Romney says, oh, I'm against that. And then the guy says, well, let me ask you something. What difference does it make? And then Romney just looked very uncomfortable, and he just kind of looks, and then he kind of just walks away. But he could tell it was a position that he didn't want to do.
Yeah.
The place he was saying, just get me out of here. John Edwards actually, I think, had the best strategy when he ran for Senate in 1998 in North Carolina. He did what's called beach tours. And this is where I think the people probably most relax is at the beach. So he would go all around beaches in North Carolina with people having signs, you know, Edwards for Senate, and he'd walk around and meet people. And people are generally in very good moods. That's why I always say that when you're doing this signature process, when you have to get a bunch of signatures basically to get somebody's name on the ballot, the worst place to do it is probably during the day in a major city when everyone's going to work and they're in a bad mood, or if they're going onto the subway. The last thing they want to do is sign papers for somebody running for office. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a beach, or for that matter, if you go into diners where people are in a little more relaxed mood, and you go, oh, can you sign this for somebody, then people might be more willing to sign it, I think.
It's a great tip. Excellent tip for anyone that may be listening right now.
If you're ever getting signatures, go to any place where people are relaxed and more likely to do it. Never go in the middle of the day when people are on the subway going to work because they're probably in a lousy mood. And the last thing they want to do is sign papers for some guy they never heard of running for cemetery commission.
Yep. Rich Rubino. Again, if people wanted to look you up online, where can they find you?
Yep. Just go to www.polita-geek.com or just find me on Facebook, too. Rich Rubino.
And the book, American Politics on the Rocks, our Monday conversation. Thank you so much for coming on to Overnight America.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
And he joins us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line on Overnight America. And Overnight America continues. All right. Got a couple of things here. You know, at midnight, I might as well do this. I was going through some of the statistics and I'm not saying I get all worked up about this, but it's ridiculous, some of the claims that the city has been putting out there regarding the need for these red light cameras to come back. You know, I'm going to use a Joe Biden phrase there. It's total malarkey. So I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into the stats. I'm going to share some of those with you right after midnight. Maybe we can talk about that again. Before we do that, I saw this online. Maybe this will be the next great conspiracy theory. Everyone growing up, when I was growing up in the 80s, they would all throw those hypotheticals out there. Elvis actually isn't dead. No, Elvis isn't. Oh, we had an Elvis sighting. I am the biggest collector of velvet Elvises, and I saw him personally. It became bigger than Bigfoot sightings. Maybe it was the precursor to the Bigfoot sightings. Oh, no. Forget about Elvis. We're going to try to find Sasquatch instead. But ever since then, people were always infatuated with the idea that Elvis Presley may still be around, or at least some of his fans were. And we're starting to see some of that with Michael Jackson now. So this is News 7 out of, I think this is Australia. Thousands of Michael Jackson enthusiasts have taken to social media to claim that a Spanish singer, Sergio Cortez, is more than just an impersonator. He is very much the iconic singer who died in 2009. Now, taking a look at Sergio and the way he looks, he's claiming that he hasn't used any actual surgeries to get him to look like Michael Jackson. I don't know why you would try to go out there and flaunt the Michael Jackson look. Did anyone think Michael Jackson, man, sure, he was okay when it came to fashion. You know, he was fashionable. He set trends. But that look, I want to look just like him. Does anyone go into the barbershop and say, give me the Michael Jackson? No one does that. Or people are considering getting plastic surgery. They go under and they do everything they can to avoid looking like Michael Jackson. But this guy is out there flaunting it, whatever. So the fans want to get DNA tests to prove that he is actually, or maybe confirm that he is not actually, the famed singer who passed away about 10 years ago. He explained that he randomly forged a career based on his looks. He said in 97, Cortez's dreams came true when he was able to meet Michael Jackson, and he was hired to be a double, a stunt double. He'd go to hotel windows and wave. How disappointing is it? Your whole life, you're thinking to yourself, man, I saw that one time I saw Michael Jackson wave out of a hotel room. I camped out for 8 hours, and finally I got a glimpse of Michael Jackson, kind of like people going to see the Pope. Oh, I got the Pope came out and waved. Now that you find out, eh, it's probably just an impersonator. I wonder if the Catholic Church does that too at the Vatican. You know, the Pope comes out, they get an impersonator. See, you know, he's got no time. Probably not, but how would you like to learn that your one sighting in life from 97 or whatever and on was just an impersonator? There's another thing, and I think Johnny Depp's a moron to begin with, but he's going to be producing a musical from the perspective of Michael Jackson's glove. You know the glove, the sequence glove, you know, the rhinestone glove or whatever it was. It's a musical that's going to be coming out soon in a couple of months. It's called For the Love of a Glove. You gotta be kidding. The unauthorized musical fable about the life of Michael Jackson as told by his glove. It's a fresh look at the strange forces that shaped Michael Jackson in the scandals. For the Love of the Glove. Man, Johnny Depp really has lost everything, hasn't he? Tell me that's just not insane. Good luck trying to watch that one. But there was one other thing that popped up before we go to break here. There was a person that online, there's some very talented people online that will create what they call mashups, which are two songs or maybe more than two songs that originally weren't recorded together, but they kind of interweave them together. And he found a Michael Jackson song and a Judas Priest song. Both came out in 1982. And he mashed them together. He used Judas Priest's You Got Another Thing Coming, a very popular hit song, still played on classic rock. Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, very popular song, still played on the radio today. So if you kind of need a little taste of both of those, like here is Judas Priest. Kind of get a feel for it, right? Yeah, 1982 this came out. All right, so if you've ever heard this song, you kind of get an idea what it's like. All right, so mostly they use the beat for Billie Jean, but it's a little bit similar to Billie Jean, I guess. You can kind of see how the two can mix in, right? All right, so that is Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. You're getting the idea. You've heard both of those songs probably about 1.5 million times. All right, so here's the mashup. Listen to these two. I want to know how people can get this creative, where they can put these things together. The millions of people enjoy these online. All right, so he uses Slayer and Wham, Pantera and Bill Withers, Slipknot and Rat and Marvin Gaye. Slayer and Katrina and the Waves. So he takes like these old like heavy metal bands from the 80s and mashes up with pop songs. They really missed an opportunity in the 80s, didn't they? Barely Michael Jackson. I don't even use him in it. So that's what this guy does. He goes online, he makes these mashup songs. And it's kind of like a fantasy as if the two played together. And they get millions and millions and millions of people listen and watch these things. Sometimes you get jealous. Wow, that's pretty creative to think to put those two songs together. That's online if you want to see it. Judas Priest and Michael Jackson mashup. It's the latest from an artist. His name is Bill McClintock. Pretty cool. All right, coming up, we're going to look at the news. We'll talk a little bit about red light cameras. I looked into the stats a little bit more. I've had zero luck with the city of St. Louis. I've tried to reach out to their communications person, and I've asked them multiple times, hey, where did you get these statistics from? I'm trying to dig a little bit deeper into this. No response. So I'm just going to go off of what I could find. And yes, there is a little bit of malarkey going on with the way that they're trying to push these red light cameras for safety. Red light cameras, it has to. It's a public epidemic. We have so many problems in the city of St. Louis. Okay, so let's look at some of the claims the city has made, and I'll back them up with some numbers. We'll do that next. And we'll take some of your calls at 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120 on Overnight America. It's KMOX.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.